Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the podcast. Excited to have Maya Solovitz on the show today. Maya is one of the premier American journalists covering addiction and drugs. Her work often appears in Time.com, The New York Times, Scientific American, Elle, Vice, and New York Magazine. She's a 2015-2016 Soros Justice Fellow and has received major awards for her coverage of neuroscience and addiction from the American Psychological Association, the Drug Policy Alliance, and the American College of Neuropsychopharmacology. Her latest book is Unbroken Brain, a revolutionary new way of understanding addiction. Thanks for chatting with me today, Maya.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
I've been wanting to chat with you for a long time about this topic and this book.
I appreciate it.
Now, this book was very personal, heavily scientifically researched. Is there a part of you that wishes you, when you were in the thick of this, had done that scientific research and had that knowledge then?
Well, I mean, yeah, it certainly would have been better if I had known early on, you know, what I was facing. But, you know, also, to be frank, the knowledge has changed. The way we saw addiction in the 80s is thankfully somewhat different to the way we see it today, although we're still struggling with the ideas left over from centuries of moralizing about this.
So let me ask a very blunt question, if I may.
Sure.
How did you go from being a gifted child and Ivy League scholarship student to injecting cocaine and heroin up to 40 times a day?
Well, that is the story of the book. But briefly, I can say that I think I had undiagnosed Asperger's syndrome as a child.
Huh.
What this meant is that the world was just too intense for me, and I was kind of overwhelmed by all kinds of normal sensory and emotional experiences, like, you know, loud sounds and itchy clothes and tastes and all of these kinds of things. This left me very socially isolated because I was always kind of just trying to deal with everything. And also the fact it was helpful in the sense that I was reading at 3 and it was clear that I was smart. But unfortunately, I decided that my inability to connect with people and my sort of controlling nature because of trying to deal with my sensory stuff meant that I was a bad person and was doomed forever to, you know, not be able to connect.
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting you said that you think you had Asperger's. Were you ever diagnosed officially with Asperger's?
I have not actually been diagnosed officially, and I sort of thought about doing that for the book. But, you know, I've had so many other diagnoses, and I kind of just feel like I know the flaws of the diagnostic system so much that it seems silly to get an official pronouncement from a system that is kind of screwy.
Yeah.
So I just figured, you know, whatever. I mean, I think that it is fair to say if you saw a 3-year-old who was reading, who had, you know, sensory overload issues, who had social problems, who was very, took everything literally, was always getting bullied, and basically had pretty much all of the classic ASPE symptoms, that, you know, I probably would have been diagnosed. I also was diagnosed with ADHD at age 3, which I did not discover until I was researching this book. I knew that I had briefly been on Ritalin, and I knew that I had been diagnosed as hyperesthetic, which basically means oversensitive. But I didn't know until I talked with my mom that actually I had gotten an ADHD diagnosis, and about a third of people with Asperger's also have ADHD. So that's kind of another clue there.
I think just taking a very granular look at this, or a very broad look at taking a very broad look at this, I think it's just incredible what you've overcome, what you've you know, the fact that you could have it at your height been doing cocaine, heroin up to 40 times a day, and then they scan your brain and they say it's normal. You know, I think this is a very, I want to like kind of start with there before we get into all the details, kind of like
sure.
the big picture here. You know, there's, I think, can give a lot of hope to a lot of our listeners. And, you know, a lot of things you say are going to be surprising to people, you know, like that the older you get, the greater your chances of recovering from addiction are and things like that. So I think that's just so interesting. And not only, quote, normal, because who, what is a normal brain, but they found that you have great cognitive control. So you kind of like emerged from this like stronger in a way, right?
I mean, yeah, it's like, it's hard to tell if that, you know, sort of superior impulse control, which I don't always feel, but which I think part of the thing that was really funny about it was I'm claustrophobic and I'm lying in the scanner and it's taking 90% of my impulse control to like not hit the to get out of there. You know, that I was actually okay on that task. I was kind of surprised about. I also did another task completely backwards. So, you know, clearly the stress was going on there. But they were able to analyze that because I did everything completely backwards so they could, you know, run it as if the positives were negative, basically. But yeah, I mean, it has been an incredible journey and it's very hard to know whether that sort of good impulse control came from recovery or allowed me to recover. And one of the things I've always thought was interesting was that I did get into recovery when I was 23, which is kind of around the time for most people that the cortex is kind of finishing itself up. And you might imagine that I was not able to stop before that because I just didn't have the ability to put on the brakes. And then finally I gained it because, you know, something allowed that to grow. Yeah, I mean, it's, I don't know if you could say any brain is normal. And I'm certainly, I don't think they would have described me as neurotypical because I don't think there is such a thing. But it was certainly the case that, you know, there was no obvious damage. And I was very glad of that, obviously. But I mean, I think one of the things that I've always thought about our conception of addiction that I find to be wrong is that I think, and I think there's a lot of data to support this, what goes wrong in addiction is that you fall in love with a drug or a compulsive behavior rather than a person or rather than becoming focused appropriately on your new baby. And we have systems in the brain that are there to change our priorities when we fall in love and to change our priorities when we have a kid and to make us persist despite negative consequences in order to maintain that relationship or successfully raise that kid. You know, if we couldn't, nobody would ever, you know, everybody would kill their kids because it would be too impossible to deal with them. You know, they have that incredible cuteness that makes you love them. And, you know, unfortunately, when that kind of intense obsession gets directed towards a drug, you end up with people behaving very strangely. And it looks like people are choosing to do this perverse thing that is, you know, destroying their life. And so I always felt that that's an example of kind of mislearning or pathological learning, but it's not really an example of brain damage. And that's not to say that if you, you know, you can damage your brain, particularly with alcohol and certainly with high doses of many different drugs. But that kind of damage that occurs is neither necessary nor sufficient to cause addiction. And we can tell this because gambling addiction exists with no chemicals whatsoever.
Well, what do you think of sex addiction? Do you think that's a real form of addiction?
Yes, I do think that. I mean, I also think that our culture kind of goes crazy with this. But I think that, you know, I've obsessed about the definition of addiction since before I actually got addicted. Mm. And the best definition that I really have found is this idea that addiction is compulsive use despite negative consequences or compulsive behavior despite negative consequences. And this is basically how you can sum up the DSM definition. This is how the National Institute on Drug Abuse defines addiction. I mean, it's a widely accepted definition at this point. And that's because if you just define addiction as like needing something to function, Prozac is addictive. You know, I mean, in the 80s, part of what allowed me to rationalize my cocaine addiction, at least, was I read, you know, in Scientific American that cocaine is no more addictive than potato chips. And now, of course, we think potato chips are addictive. But the point really is that addiction has to involve compulsion and harm. It isn't just needing something, because if it was just needing something or depending on something, we'd all be addicted to each other. We'd all be addicted to air. We'd all be addicted to food. It just would become a kind of useless concept.
I have a confession to make. I am kind of addicted to air.
Yeah. I mean, you know, people will do some pretty intense things.
So I've been thinking about like labeling, and I remember when we had met in New York a couple years ago, we talked a little bit about labeling, and we're talking about the ungifted. And I read in the book that you say that like labeling is not necessarily a bad thing. I think there's a funny quote in there by Elder Robinson, maybe saying, "I would rather have a label than being called what I'm called on the street."
Yes. Right? Yes.
Yeah. So.
I mean, I thought, yes, and I thought that was kind of profound. I think that what sometimes unfortunately happens with children, and that can have a terrible effect on your long-term development and mental health, is that if you are an outlier, if you don't fit in, if you feel very different, and you don't have any kind of label or any kind of way of understanding that, you might give yourself, or other people might give you, all kinds of labels that are harmful, like selfish and bad and, you know, completely unable to socialize. And instead of, you know, when I learned about Asperger's syndrome, I was like, oh my gosh, there's an explanation for all these weirdnesses about me, and they all fit together. Before that, I just had thought that, like, I'm socially awkward. I have these intense sensory and emotional dysregulation experiences. It just didn't fit together. I think that with children, you know, some children would take that ASPIE label and be like, okay, you know, this brings some advantages and some disadvantages, but at least I'm not a Martian. At least I'm not, you know, bad. At least this is a thing that is recognized that something can be done about. Now, other kids might react to it and be like, well, this means I'll never have friends and it's limiting and, you know, I can't do anything. And obviously that is not the reaction you want. But I think, you know, when we can understand these collections of symptoms that tend to hang together, it can really help people understand themselves. And we have to be careful not to make a label into a sort of prophecy. It's just sort of a thing you can use to help yourself understand yourself and other people. And understand, you know, the way you react to the world. I mean, you know, it was very interesting because I had actually written an earlier version of this book when I was in my 20s.
No way.
Yeah, yeah. And
do you have it saved?
Yeah, I had it. I used it. So that, I mean, it's interesting because there were certain things that I now disagree with in terms of my view on addiction. But the, you know, raw emotional and sensory experience was there. And when I did write that, I had never heard anything about autism or Asperger's or anything like this. And I was really curious when I went back and read it to see, you know, what kind of emphasis I placed on the sensory stuff and on the dysregulation and this kind of stuff. And it was all right there. It was not like I had retrospectively imposed this framework on it. It was all really visible there. So it was, that was, I was really glad that I had that to work with. And that I hadn't had to later disagree with myself publicly. But it was really useful because it did give me, you know, the freshness and the rawness of the period of early recovery and the experience of, you know, undergoing such a dramatic change.
That is so cool that you kept that, and what a valuable resource that was for you. You know, I thinking about this case, we talk in the book about how you want to place addiction as in the same category as developmental disorders and talk about the importance of learning in addiction. And I was thinking about this. You were talking about the patients who maybe are on morphine went for a couple of weeks to help them with pain. And then when they come home, they might feel like sick, like nauseous, or but they don't know what to attribute it to. So they just sort of like, you know, kind of just wade through it, right? But they may think to that, but the thing is, what they might actually be going through is addiction withdrawal symptoms. But yep. Because they don't know, ignorance is bliss when it comes to addiction. It sounds like you're saying, if I had to summarize it in a sentence.
Well, I think it's very interesting because I was speaking with some doctors. You know, obviously we have a big opioid problem right now. And I was speaking with some doctors about, well, what if you just didn't even tell people they were being given opioids?
Right, right. You should do the experiment.
But the thing that is interesting there is that, right, you cannot be addicted unless you know what you're addicted to. Otherwise, you can't go out and seek it despite negative consequences. And this is another thing about the importance of the distinction between addiction and physical dependence. Because, you know, like a baby can be physically dependent. Like a baby can unfortunately be born with, you know, opioids in their system. And since they were in the womb and that was the background for them, they have physical dependence on it. But that baby does not know that heroin is what it needs. All that baby knows is that it feels uncomfortable. But that might mean I need to be breastfed. I need to be hugged. I need to be changed. Like it could mean anything that a baby, you know, experiences discomfort about. And also since the baby can't exactly, you know, crawl out of the hospital and get itself to a drug dealer, it cannot continue to use despite negative consequences. And this sounds like a silly distinction, but it really matters because when we labeled children as crack addicted during the 80s, that label was actually more harmful to some of those children than the drug itself. And that was because people interpreted their behavior as evil when it was actually sort of normal toddler behavior. And that set up sort of negative spirals for some of these kids. I mean, I wrote about a case once where there were these four kids who were adopted and their parents were starving. The adoptive parents were starving them. And they were, you know, the 20-year-old was something like so skinny that he looked like a 4-year-old. I mean, it was horribly creepy. But the way, like, the social workers had been in and out of these people's house and everybody thought they were wonderful. The other kids were fine. Everybody thought they were these wonderful parents because they were putting up with these horrible crack babies who had this horrible behavior and they were anorexic somehow from crack, even though, of course, it was now 20 years since they'd been exposed to it. But it's the idea that crack turns you into a horrible monster, right, who should be punished by withholding food that did way more damage than that exposure in the womb could have done to these kids.
Look, I love the humanity that you put into this, into this topic, which is really rare in discussions of addiction. You say addiction is not a sin or a choice. It's not a chronic brain disease like Alzheimer's. And you do place it in the class of developmental disorder. I would like to really unpack this further because, you know, I'm not 100% convinced. There are some things I'm trying to understand. Like, you know, when you have a developmental disorder, let's say you're on the autism spectrum and you show repetitive behaviors. Let's try an analogy of some sort. And you show very narrow interests, but you're very obsessive to the point of maybe obsession about a particular repetitive structure or something, whether it's music or it could be creative things. I mean, we underestimate the extent to which people on the autism spectrum that even being obsessed about something in particular can still lead to development of greatness, right?
Absolutely, yeah.
So is it more of a, like, the similarity there is not in terms of the potential harmfulness of the object of obsession despite negative. But the thing is, with the developmental disorders, what is the negative aspect? In the way that you defined addiction, what is the persisting despite negative results? What is that in the autism or the ADHD?
So if you think about, like, the way I think about addiction as a developmental disorder is as a very complex, heterogeneous one, just like everything else in psychiatry. So if you think about it, okay, developmental disorders have certain characteristics. One of them is that they tend to have an onset at a specific time in life, at a specific part of brain development. And this is really true of addiction since 90% of it starts in the teens or early 20s, which is exactly the time before the cortex has fully developed and the time when you are really developing those systems that are involved in mating and reproduction. So this, you know, this is one clue to this. Another clue to it is that there are sort of many different pathways into it. So, you know, if you have autism or ADHD, there may be many different genetics that lead you to that. And with addiction, you know, for example, let's say you have, you know, ADHD increases the odds of addiction by like factor of 4 or 5. It's something really large. You know, and I think that is because of the sort of sensory and the dysregulation that it imposes on your nervous system and how that makes it hard to fit in with other people and just be comfortable and just pay attention. But, you know, which gene creates that? Who knows, right? So I think, you know, the other thing that's interesting about developmental disorders is that they sort of unfold based on these, you know, sort of small influences at particular times in development. So let's say, like, I think all psychiatric disorders are developmental. So let's take like depression, for example. You know, let's say a kid starts hating themselves because they feel alienated and they feel like they have no friends and nobody likes them. And then they start ruminating on that. And that comes on top of like some kind of temperament that already predisposed them to feel a little sad about the world. And then their parents also have a depressive style, let's say. So all of that coming at a time when the brain is forming itself can kind of build in these grooves that end up leading towards the direction of depression. And then that pain that comes from the experience of depression can lead you during adolescence to try to, you know, find ways to feel better. And drugs can often be a way of doing that. And then when you have exposed yourself to a substance that seems to work, at least at first, that sets you up for the pattern of the compulsive use despite negative consequences. And it also sets you up to not learn the coping skills that could instead help you avoid getting so locked into that one behavior.
So yeah, that does make sense. So I'm trying to think of like everything in this world. Everything has like a point where it's adaptive and then it gets too much and it's not adaptive anymore. You know, yes. Like everything. I'm just trying to take a very, very broad view here. So love is not necessarily addictive, but love can become addictive. Having obsessive and...
I actually think, to just interrupt for a second there, I actually think that
love... I was
love-
on a roll though. No, I'm sorry. Go on.
I think that love is the template for addiction. I think that like it's like the thing in the brain that predisposes us to addiction. Now, it may also be the case that food seeking and behavior around food is another template for addiction, but it's these fundamental survival systems that are going to set your priorities towards seeking this particular thing.
That's exactly where I was going with this. You know, so at a very broad level, absolutely, we have basic needs that from like a cybernetic perspective, like regulate itself to reach homeostasis. It wants it to reach homeostasis. We can go beyond love. We can also talk about being addicted to esteem, which is what narcissism is, my view is. That's how I view narcissism, is addiction to esteem. So you can become addicted to any of our basic needs, and in a way that makes it, like you said, absolutely shifts our priorities. You're very, I think, very Maslow about this. It becomes a very prepotent need. We kind of prioritize it over other goals in our life. It kind of like snaps it into that being the primary goal in our life. So our purpose, all of our higher level goals kind of get, you know, put aside. So I think that's true. So what I'm trying to think is like from within the same framework of developmental disorders and psychiatric disorders, maybe that's all part of the same thing. So like it's very adaptive to find repetitive, sort of stable, secure things. You know, security is a basic need as well, right? But you could find also we can become, you know, like there are people and dispositions that when it interacts with certain environmental, et cetera, they become extraordinarily sensitive to disorder and to things that are chaotic. And people with autism really like certainty and like to know things that are repetitive. And you can go case by case and go like ADHD, you know, it was adaptive for exploration. The exploration need is what I would say driving that. And that's what I'm working on in this new theory. I'm working on that the exploration is a basic human need, but again, you could become addicted to exploration. So I think everything has its homeostasis point and then its addictive point. When I say everything, I'm saying all biological needs.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really interesting point. And I think that, you know, what often, you know, basically these are sort of cycles that elaborate themselves. And if you get stuck in the wrong groove, it becomes pathological. You can get stuck in a good groove and then you're like a brilliant composer, right? And your obsession with understanding, you know, music theory is going to, you know, pay off in all kinds of wonderful ways, in a way that like your obsession with spinning a wheel on a car, a toy car, would probably not do. So I think one of the characteristics of being on the spectrum may be sort of learning too quickly. Like you lock into something before you get very quickly, oh, there's an association here, but you like sort of fixate on it instead of being flexible about it. And sometimes that's useful and sometimes that's harmful. But right, all of these things and all of these ways of connecting and understanding the world, you know, have good sides and bad sides. And I think, you know, this is why I really do like, and I talk a little bit of in the book about the idea that, you know, the things that, you know, can cause us the greatest harm may also be able to allow us the greatest joy if we can direct them appropriately. And I mean, I do think that the persistence through obstacles is really useful, you know, as long as you're not like seeking drugs. If you're seeking like success, if you're trying to, you know, make your relationship work, if you're trying to do things that are productive, like, you know, nobody could ever succeed in the arts if they weren't able to persist despite rejection.
Love that. I love that you put two things together that have typically not been put together, neurodiversity and that people who are what we call addicted in society, or put that label on. I love how you put it under a bigger umbrella of appreciation and tolerance. So I love that. I love that.
I have been very, very pleased by the fact that the autism world has not freaked out by me saying should embrace people with addiction as neurodiverse. I was a little anxious because of the stigma around addiction that a lot of people would feel like, you know, oh, like those are the bad people and you know, you shouldn't be comparing it. And I was really interested to see a study that came out. It was looking at like basically the entire Swedish population from certain years. And they found that people with autism diagnoses who had normal to high IQ actually had double the risk of addiction compared to the population. And, you know, I'd sort of thought, oh, well, I'm just kind of really a weirdo in this too. But I started talking to other people on the spectrum who also have addictions and for this article that I wrote about that. And it was really quite fascinating.
Oh, yeah. I think that, you know, you find in the autism community just great tolerance and just the neurodiversity community in general for anything. But where do we draw the line? I find this a very stimulating conversation. And so I have like really, you know, unbaked questions for you, but that I'm so excited to get a chance to explore with someone. And that's what I love to do in this podcast anyway. I'm just like, I'm addicted to curiosity. That's my probably downfall in life. You know, sometimes
curiosity is essential. I mean, and
well,
it, you know,
but I'm addicted to it. No, I don't know. I don't know about that. Okay. Look, when I was reading your book, like I saw a new book idea in my head as a cheek, because I'm cheeky. I'm a little bit cheeky. I'm like, okay, well, serial killers, let's put them part of the neurodiverse. Now, I'm not saying serial killers are the same, and that's not all what I'm saying, but I'm saying we could take this. What happens if we scale this up and we say, I think I could make a case that like rapists, serial killers, like, you know, they're like, it's some kind of like extreme alteration of what's basic drive in all of us. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, I am actually quite interested in antisocial personality disorder
me too.
And psychopathy. And I think that if you look at the neurology of psychopathy, you can make as good an argument for it being a brain disease as you can for addiction being a brain disease or for depression being a brain disease. And nobody wants to wrestle with that. Psychopathy was not put into the DSM so that it could not be used as an excuse for criminal behavior. And it is, you know, both ASPD and psychopathy, which is the extreme of ASPD basically, are kind of diagnoses of being a bad person.
Yep.
You cannot have those conditions without harming others. Like you can have addiction without, it's like not essential to hurt others to be addicted,
correct.
You know, and it's not essential to hurt others to be depressed, even though in both of those instances, others will often be hurt. But you cannot be antisocial without harm. And so I keep thinking about writing this and I've never really just got down and done it, but I do think we need to deal with that because what, you know, it's not your fault that you are wired in a way such that you don't feel fear and you have difficulty with empathy. But it's not other people's fault that you, because of that wiring, you might kill them. So
Right. Exactly. So if someone is coming at, because I try to practice, I just thought of another book title. How about Radical Acceptance of Others?
Yes.
Not of yourself, because there's so many books on radical acceptance of yourself, you know? But anyway. You know, like self-compassion, like there's so many books on that. But what about like, what would radical acceptance of others look like? It would go to the extreme in the sense that now if someone is coming at me with a machete, you know, an antisocial person, I'm not going to say, you know what, I really have tolerance and respect for the kind of brain wiring you have. And I want to give you a membership in the neurodiversity movement. Now, I wonder maybe if I did say that, maybe they'd put the machete down and give me a hug. Who knows?
Seems unlikely though.
Yeah. But there does seem to be a difference. So with addiction, though, it is a kind of harm, like self-harm in a way.
Right. Well, no, it certainly is. And I mean, like, you know, I've always like thought that the term drug abuse was really dumb. And I'm very glad that it got out of the DSM because you're not abusing the poor little drug. You might be abusing yourself, but that is a term that has been used for other things. You know, you cannot be addicted without harm to yourself. because by definition,
that's your definition. Yeah.
It involves harm. And I think it's important that it involves harm, because otherwise you can just be like, oh, I'm like addicted to playing the piano. And, you know, and you could be addicted to playing the piano if like you are ignoring your wife and your kids and your job to do that. It would be a very rare thing, but you could see that that could potentially happen. But if there's no harm, there's no addiction, because otherwise is too expensive. But with antisocial personality disorder or psychopathy, the problem of harm to others is fundamental. And I don't think as a society, we have wrestled with how do you deal with the fact that some of us probably are wired to have no empathy.
Yeah.
And I think there is a person that we are dealing with as a nation right now that has that issue. And I actually feel that the psychiatric community has done a real disservice by avoiding looking at that. But that is probably a different conversation. I think, though, that we need to deal with, I mean, I also, like, here we always get back, the Scandinavians tend to do everything right. But they
punishment and
oh. You know, they deal with it, but they what they do with, you know, antisocial people who simply cannot be rehabilitated is they incarcerate them, but in nice conditions.
Yeah.
And like, I think that is a sensible strategy. I am astonished by the Norwegians' ability to put up with that evil guy, you know, who slaughtered so many kids, and then he's complaining about his cell conditions aren't nice. And they're like, oh, let's look at that.
Yeah. I had to bite my lip to have that kind of tolerance. Yeah.
No, I mean, and I think that's like really, you know, extraordinary and admirable. But it is, you know, I wish that as a diverse society, we could achieve that kind of solidarity. But it's a lot easier to do it in a small homogeneous community. And I think the biggest question of how to, you know, govern ourselves involves how do we include diversity without splitting into pieces.
Absolutely. And I do recognize that this conversation is probably going to be controversial to a certain segment of our listeners, but I think it's worth having a discussion because, or at least I hope it's worth, I hope it was a fair point because, you know, I like to apply, if you raise a logical argument to me, I want to think how it logically applies to everything. Not, right, you know, right. I mean, that's just the way my mind works. I don't circumscribe it just to the nice and pretty things, right? Like, so taking that to nth degree, I think that we would have to come to terms with this framework. And, you know, if we view lots of things as adaptations that are alternative strategies, which is how I do like to view lots of these things, as alternative evolved strategies to for survival and reproduction. I mean, there are lots of things that...
Well, right. And I mean, like, you know, you can argue that part of the evolution of altruism involved having to evade the non-altruists, right?
Correct, yeah.
So, you know, and it's also the case that there are situations in which empathy is a handicap. When you are a surgeon and operating on somebody's brain, you don't want to be thinking about that person as a human being. The surgeon needs to be focused on the, I am fixing this little piece, not like, oh my God, I might slip and destroy a human.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, I think that, you know, there are situations where just absolutely shutting off empathy is productive, right?
But I would say not shutting off compassion.
I don't know. I mean, I just think that, like, what you need is really strong systemizing at that moment. And, you know, like, I just want them to be, like, doing the mechanics here and not thinking about, like, oh, I feel so nice for this person, but more like, I am going to make sure I don't like nick this thing that will destroy somebody.
So empathy is different than compassion. I'm just doing a thought experiment about the person, the doctor without compassion. I don't think it would motivate them to do a good a job and be as meticulous because they wouldn't care as much about the outcome.
Maybe they're just caring about how much they're going to get paid.
Okay.
And they know that they're going to get sued and lose money if they have a bad outcome.
Maybe I'm too innocent.
I mean, I'm just making this up, but I think that, you know, and I'm certainly not saying that doctors should be jerks, but I am saying that, like, it is understandable why they often are jerks, particularly surgeons. Yeah. And it is the case that it is adaptive to turn off compassion in the hospital sometimes, because otherwise you would just be too overwhelmed and you'd go in a corner and you couldn't help anybody. So, you know, it's complicated. And some of the traits that we think are completely useless, like impulsivity,
right,
can be useful in some setting.
For sure.
And you know, some of these antisocial things, like where you're disregarding the reviews of others and this kind of thing. Again, there are certain circumstances in which that may be adaptive and productive. The problem is, as with all of this stuff, like when it causes harm and how you deal with how responsible that person may be for that behavior.
Good. I really appreciate that nuance. We really kind of went on a bit of a tangent there. It was my fault, but this is what happens when you stick two people who have characteristics of what someone would call ADHD together in a conversation.
Yes, wandering does occur.
Yeah. But this is great. I find this a really scintillating conversation. And then the other thing I was thinking is, like, with drug addiction, it seems like I'm still not 100% convinced. I'm trying to think of it as a developmental disorder because I do see the role of learning, but I also don't think it's – and you would certainly not say it's 100% all about learning. There are some things that are inherently more rewarding than others from a biological perspective. So, you
know,
that's
true.
Like these things like hijack or operate on our striatum and our lower order reward systems in such a way that it's irresistible to those systems that evolved. Do you know what I'm saying?
What's interesting is that, you know, 80 to 90% of people who try heroin do not become addicted. And, you know, most people who gamble do not become addicted.
Well, can I ask a follow-up question about that? Because I kind of want to try heroin now that you said that.
No, like, always usually say right after that, that does not mean you should go try it. You would not fly on a plane that crashes 10% of the time.
Exactly. So yeah, that's my question is like, it's still like heroin can still be dangerous for you physically, even though if it's not addictive, like you shouldn't, that doesn't mean that it's okay to try heroin.
Well, I mean, the thing is that, like, you know, if you were to be given an injection of heroin in that was a safe and pure dose in a medical setting, and somebody had Narcan just in case you happen to have an overdose, I'm not recommending this. But the thing is that these are drugs that in some settings, you know, if you are in extreme pain, are angels and miracle drugs, and in other settings are going to kill you and going to, you know, destroy your life. So I think that it is certainly the case that the drug is not irrelevant.
Well, okay. So this is so interesting because, like, I'm trying to think about other things who are equally as rewarding or almost equally as rewarding from a biological perspective that we do every day of our lives. So for instance, when I eat pizza, every time I eat pizza, the greasier the pizza, the more, I bet it's really scintillating my striatum. My striatum loves that, the pizza.
You know, we think that, like, oh, something like heroin, like, you know, it hijacks your brain or whatever. Right. But the fact is that most people retain control over their use. Fact. And most people who are exposed to opioids do not become addicted. In fact, about a third of people exposed to opioids find them more unpleasant than pleasant. Another third kind of finds them, some parts are pleasant, some parts are not. And then it's that final third that are like, oh, this is the best thing ever. But what's interesting about that is one third of people do not, you know, who try opioids don't become addicted because within that group, a lot of people are like, wow, this is the best thing ever. I am not going to do it again because I don't want to lose my family, my job, et cetera, et cetera. This was a nice, blissful experience. But, you know, if I ever have to be exposed to this, I want, you know, the doctor to be very careful of monitoring me.
I think that's really important because I experienced lots of things in my life that I think to myself, oh, I could so easily get addicted to this. Again, the pizza, but there are a lot of things in my life that, and people, you know, okay, listeners, use your imagination, you know, like, but like,
sure,
but,
yeah,
there are lots of things in one's life that I think, you know, but I do have that sort of higher level conscious reflection, mindfulness about it that I make the decision. But what is the difference between, like, what would put me over the
edge? Right. So here's what often does. And I mean, these are the things that tend to set people up for addiction. Obviously, we've talked about how oftentimes it's exposure during these developmentally sensitive periods, right? Also, if you have severe childhood trauma, like about two-thirds of people with addiction have been exposed to at least one traumatic experience. The more and the different types and the more extended the traumatic experience, the greater the risk. About 50% of people have also, with addiction, also have a other mental illness.
I see.
And so that sets you up for it. And then the third kind of biggie is like existential and economic despair and a sense of hopelessness. Because really, I mean, you know, and this is where, you know, certainly in poor communities, you know, people have made an argument in the past that addiction is a rational choice when mm-hmm. your alternative is like McDonald's.
Or death, if people are right. Mortality, high mortality rates, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, at some point, like certainly using drugs in that circumstance can be seen as a rational choice. I don't think addiction is actually the rational choice, but certainly using drugs to escape and create an identity and a purpose for yourself in a world that seems meaningless and purposeless, that is a part of addiction for many people. And this is also why for many people, like God or spirituality can be an answer to that, because that can be an answer to existential questions for some people. So this is not to say that there aren't medical and learning and all kinds of other aspects to it. But if you, you know, it is like depression in the sense that there is an existential piece of it.
Good. I'm really glad you added that nuance, because I want to make clear, you're not making the argument learning is the only piece. You're saying it's a crucial piece that's been missed out. A lot of people kind of equate it, like you're dispelling the myth of the instant addiction.
And exactly.
I think that's really important. Absolutely. So I'm glad you added these other layers onto it as well, because I think all the it's like a system. All the pieces are important. And yeah. You're saying learning is one important part of that system as well that gets neglected.
No, exactly. And what I'm trying to say is that we've sort of, as a society, had this sort of chronic brain disease model of addiction. And that model often ignores social factors, often has been seen to ignore learning, and can often be stigmatizing. And in America is like deeply entwined with the 12-step and the moral and the spiritual approach to addiction. So what I'm trying to say is just that, okay, we're all going to agree addiction's a medical problem. What kind of a medical problem is it? It's a developmental problem that occurs in the context of all of these things. And, you know, learning brings in culture, because like you don't learn in a vacuum. And learning brings in all of these other things because it is where the environment and the genes meet. So that is why I have really tried to emphasize that, because if you just see it as a chronic progressive disease, like Alzheimer's, that can be a pretty hopeless view. And if you see your brain as like irreparably damaged and you're always going to have to be fighting it, that is a serious problem. Now, this is not to say that I think it's safe for me to go shoot heroin, but it is certainly to say that like, I do not spend any time thinking about, oh gosh, it'd be really nice to do opiates. And I did spend a lot of time thinking about that in my early recovery, you know, and I have gotten better. You know, it's like when you break up with somebody, like, you know, at first it's like really, really right. hard, yeah. you know, and yeah. like now it's like, okay, they're my ex. I don't care, you know.
Yeah. Such a good point. I want to end here with the one line you wrote in the book, which you probably didn't mean it to be as deep as I read it to be, but I found it like, when I read this line, I was like, that is one of the most profound things I've ever read in my life. Okay, so it's a very seemingly simple line. You wrote, "We all learn to become who we are." Holy cow, Maya. No. I mean, if you really think through, like if you really sit down and reflect on the meaning of that for all areas of our lives, that's pretty profound, right?
Well, and I mean, I did mean that in the
okay,
in
good.
Expanded sense, because, you know, that is how we become who we are, right?
Wow.
Like by learning. And we are learning in all different contexts, in the context of our neurology, in the context of our sociology, in the context of our psychology, our parents. I am trying to bring the sort of multifactorial nature of this together. And learning is at the center of that, because it is how we become who we are. And so when you become addicted, that is one of the elements that becomes a part of that. And I think one of the interesting things about the whole neurodiversity thing is, you know, a lot of autistic people are very like, I'm autistic, like proud of that, and very much like, you know, seeing that as central to their identity. And so much so that they don't like people with autism, they want to be called autistic people, right? And then there's this other view, well, oh, my addiction is separate from me. I'm a person with addiction, not an addict. You know, so there's, I mean, I think there's very interesting layers of what parts of yourself you embrace and what parts of yourself you say, well, that's not me, right? And I am trying to you know, have an inclusive sense of self that can deal with the things that are problematic, but also can acknowledge that these things can also, you know, bring, you know, good things. I think, you know, there are certainly instances where disabling conditions are just disabling and they're not bringing any benefits. But I also think that if we are faced with whatever we have and whatever we are, we may as well look for the upside in where we are at.
Well, look, I want to thank you for such a refreshing take on this topic and for chatting with me today. Thank you, Maya.
Oh, thanks so much. This was fun.
Thank you so much for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as thought-provoking as I did. If something you heard today stimulated you in some way, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com.